Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Normally, by now, we'd be past the All-Star break and heading into baseball's pivotal dog days. This year, opening day for a 60-game season was pushed all the way back to Thursday because of the coronavirus pandemic. Whatever it looks like, my guest Jay Horwitz will be part of the baseball season as usual, as has been the case for four decades now. The New York Mets' longtime PR head, who now works in alumni relations, Horwitz is the author of a new memoir, Mr. Met. It traces his career from college sports information to the big leagues in the number one media market. Jay Horwitz, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
What do you think of the baseball season and what it's going to look like this year?
Well, you know, like you said in the introduction, I'm not really that much involved the last 2 years with the current day team. And I just hope that, they can, everybody can stay healthy, get a season in. And, if your team is in contention in September, I think everybody's still going to be excited. And I really like the Mets' chances to have a good young team. And with Pete Alonso and Cespedes is healthy. So I think the Mets can do very well. And I really like the new manager, Louis Rojas. So I'm excited about for Mets fans. I think they're going to have a good year.
A lot of your book is about times when the team wasn't so good and you still had to find a way to, drum up attention for the team or things like that. If you were in your old role doing PR for such a strange baseball season, what would you be doing right now?
Well, I'd be stressing charity work. I think people want to hear feel-good stories. What are the players doing off the field? You know, how are they trying to reconnect with the community the people who come down with the virus to do some, work with hospitals, to work in community centers, to reach out to kids. Could be kind of an awkward situation because there's no fans involved. But give an example of what we're doing now with our alumni team. We're doing Zoom calls to nursing homes in the area because the people can't get out. And just to get the people about, what it is to get to talk to a baseball player and talk baseball. So just try to reach out to the fan base who can't be there. Just try and reconnect whenever you can with fans.
Let's talk a little bit about your new job the last couple of seasons in alumni relations.
Right.
You say that's an area where the Mets, they didn't do it a lot before. So why did you want to go into that role?
Well, to be honest, I was hired by the Mets in 1980 to be the PR guy. And in 2018, Jeff Wilpon, one of our owners, came to me and said, Jay, what do you think about switching jobs? The next year, which would have been last year, was the 50th anniversary of the Miracle Mets in 69. Do you want to work with these guys? We really haven't done a whole lot with the alumni. And I honestly, my first reaction, I wasn't crazy about it. I like to travel. I like the camaraderie in the locker room. I said, okay, let me give it a chance. And I'm really glad that I did. What we try to do is reconnect with the people, bring them back to the Mets family. The last 2 years, we brought players in full uniform to spring training in St. Lucie, Ron Swoboda, Mike Hampton, Jerry Grody, Cleon Jones. They signed autographs. And I'll give you one example. We had the first player the Mets signed in 1961 was a catcher named Hobie Landreth. I called him about a half a year ago, and after he said to me, Jay, you're the first person from the Mets organization to call me in 50 years. And now in a nutshell, we're just trying to let these guys who are part of Mets history, let them know we gave a damn and trying to feel good about themselves and trying to make them feel good about being a Met player.
In your own role, you write about in your book how much camaraderie you had with certain teams, especially 86, which gets so much attention, when they were much closer in age to you. Was it harder to do your job as you got older and, the average player stayed in his 20s?
Well, I'll tell you what, it wasn't, I never considered myself to be a suit. I wanted to be, I always found to get it along in the locker room, you have to adjust to the climb in the locker room. I'll give you a story of the present day. When I was working on my book, the people at Triumph Books said, who do you have a good relationship on the current team? I said, Jacob deGrom. So this is Jacob and I, I'm about 40 years older than Jacob deGrom. So what we did, I would say, Jacob, I need you to do an interview. He said, okay, Jay, I'll do the interview for you. But we had a basketball court in the locker room. You have to make two or three shots for me to do the interview. I never made two or three shots, but with the team watching, I kind of make a jerk of myself, and I miss. He did the interview. On another occasion, he would say, okay, I'll do the interview for this time, but you have to go on the field, and it fun goes to me and Steve and Matt for a half hour, then I'll do the interview. and I didn't really do too well with that. The point is, I never took myself seriously. I was always okay to make myself the butt of jokes. And that's how I got along with the younger guys through the years. I didn't want to be a front office suit. I had to develop a layer of trust with them, and I was there to help them. When the guys came up, I gave them really simple advice. You know, if you have a part of the game, good or bad, be in front of your locker. Be honest with the press. The press is not your friends. Understand that, but be truthful with them. And that's what I try to do, just let these guys know that I cared about them as people, not to always go to them asking them for things, you know, be there, hey, can you do something? Does your wife need something? Your kid needs kids, I think, okay with your kid's school. And that was really a secret for how I was able to exist in the locker rooms for 40 years.
You say that one of the mistakes you made early on in your time with the Mets was kind of overexposure with Daryl Strawberry.
Right. So when Daryl comes up in May of 1983, we weren't a really good team. You know, when Daryl was first number one pick in the country, he was called the Black Ted Williams. And what I did, I said yes to everything. Could have been a small radio station in Dubuque, Iowa. You could have been a newspaper with a circulation of 10. I said yes to everything. I overexposed Daryl, and it put a lot of pressure on him. But Daryl showed a lot of strength, and he regrouped, and we had 26 homers that year and became the Rookie of the Year. And, you know, slowly but surely, the Mets got better. The next month after Daryl, we traded for Keith Hernandez. And for me, one of the key points in the Mets' success in the 80s when we hired Davey Johnson after the World Series of 83. You know, Davey didn't need the money. He was a millionaire, successful real estate guy, flew his own plane, got his degree in mathematics from Texas A&M. But he brought a breath of confidence to the team, and we got better players. I mean, he wasn't afraid to take chances on young guys like Wally Backman and Lenny Dykstra. You know, when Dwight, 1983, Dwight Gooden, he struck out 300 batters in Lynchburg in 83. There was a lot of debate in the front office, bring him up or not bring him up, and Davey said, bring him up. So Dwight was the Rookie of the Year that year, and next year he was the Cy Young Award winner. So probably from 84 to 90, you know, we won average over 90 wins a year. Unfortunately, we only won once, probably should have won more. But that was probably the most success we've had, you know, from 84 to 90. We were either first or second in every year of those years.
You see some guys who come into that ecosystem, and you mentioned, you know, the reporters, they're famous in New York for being really tough, the back pages in the heyday of the tabloid era. A lot can go wrong for even very talented players in New York. What makes someone able to succeed and thrive on that, in your opinion?
Well, to be honest, I mean, you know, Dwight and Daryl Strawberry, two perfect examples. They had off-the-field problems. They never ran. They always stood in front of their locker when problems happened. And, you know, the media, this is why to this day they're regarded as folk heroes. And thankfully, both guys have turned their lives around. You know, Daryl and his wife Tracy are now ministers. They travel around the country, preach against the evil of the drugs. And, you know, Dwight does a lot of work in high schools. And he does a lot of work. It's like a Hackensack Hospital. He visits cancer kids. And basically, the stories are the same. Don't do as I did. You know, learn from my mistakes. And they're very uninhibited about telling people the mistakes they made, the past with drugs and other things. You know, they're great examples. And I speak to them probably, you know, once a week at least. Or, you know, one thing about my new job, I'm able to stay in contact with the guys I've worked with for so long. And, you know, we've done a lot of alumni work this year because until there was no baseball, a lot of the meeting in the New York market was looking for historical stuff, talking about Dwight's Cy Young season, Daryl's Rookie of the Year season. So it was, you know, I'm really proud of the way both guys have turned their life around.
You've been through too many GMs and managers and coaches to name.
Right.
When something was going poorly, you know, there's some bad years in Mets history, and, you know, maybe a manager didn't have a contract beyond the year or there was a firing mid-season. How did you handle that in your role, knowing that, hey, we're going to go through some bad press here and it's going to be, you know, somewhat awkward?
I took it really personal. You know what? I mean, you got to understand one thing. With baseball, you're with the family from, like, February, if you're in the playoffs, October, November. And when guys get fired, it really hurts. They're part of your family. When I remember when Art Howe was let go, you know, I was really crying in his office with him, helping him pack up his stuff. You know, you try and prepare him for what's happening. You try and give him what's going on. Like, before each manager, you have a briefing, you know, before the game, after the game. You try and give these guys a heads up at what type of questions they might get. And when some guys lose their jobs, it's really, it's you know, you read the paper, Art Howe's fired. Art Howe has a wife and two daughters. You know, and people don't understand that. And, you know, me, I took it personally. I, you know, when a manager didn't work out, maybe how could I have helped them more? What else could I have done? You know, it's a family-oriented business. Like, you know, I speak to a lot of my PR friends, like the guys in the NBA. They say, well, we have three games this week. Well, baseball, we have 162 games, 40 exhibition games. If you're in the playoffs, another 20 or 30 games. So it's well over 200 games, and you're with these guys all year long, and they become part of your family fabric.
Did you yourself take losses personally? I mean, you can't get too high or too low in baseball because, like you say, it's every day.
I did. The thing I hated and not hated, I always try to be professional. One thing about my job, whether the team lost 100 games or won 100 games, I try to be professional in the locker room. I had a thing, you know, we had got a winning hit. I have a chapter in the book on, you know, Shannon Ford, who was my assistant for so long, and she passed away all too young from breast cancer.
Yeah, 44.
Age 44. Anytime something happened, I would tap her shoulder, or we had a sign together. We couldn't cheer because I didn't want to. You know, you can root for your team, but you still have to be professional, and you know, to cheer in the press box was not a good thing. So we find other ways to celebrate, and we went out to the locker room with the players, and we could celebrate. While we're up there, I try to be professional all the time and not to cheer or yell or scream, because that's just not the way to do your job.
How did your job change with the coming of the internet and social media in the last decade or so?
That, in a nutshell, I mean, when I first started, I used to write press releases about everything, trades and injuries. Now everything is on Twitter. Like, you know, the players announce stuff on their own. The agents leak stuff. The newspaper guys write it on Twitter. You know, right now we used to have these media seminars in the spring, and just to tell the players they have to be much more alert now than they were 30 years ago. You go into an elevator. Who stand next to an elevator? You go to a bar. Who are you next to at a bar? You know, this story of Michael Phelps, the swimmer, a couple of years ago, he got into trouble because somebody put on Twitter from he was some kind of a party, which he should have been. So the guys today have to be more in tune, you know, even in the locker room. Whose hat do you have hanging in your locker? What do you have that you don't want to see? They have to be more on their toes and have to be aware of all their surroundings, which really wasn't the case in 1980.
We're speaking with Jay Horowitz. He's the author of a memoir called Mr. Met. He was the longtime Mets PR person and now works in alumni relations. Jay, a few questions about your personal life. You were a sports writer out of college, and then you were working at Fairleigh Dickinson as a sports information person,
right,
which got off to a very inauspicious start. Will you tell us that story?
Sure. It was December 1st, 1972. We're playing the University of Maine in Orono, Maine, and I was the official scorer. It was part of my job. I mistakenly wrote down the wrong names in the scorebook. We started the game with two technical fouls, and we lost the game 68-67. Al Balbo, who would become a good friend, like a second father, he comes by the scorebook and the score table and said, "Now I know why ... NYU dropped basketball. You're a moron." And I was so embarrassed. I mean, it was my first day at a job. I cost the team a loss, but it did get better. Now, Al's coach was Bobby Knight, Mike Krzyzewski at Army, and he and his wife Ruth became like my second set of parents. But it didn't get off to a really good start that night.
How did you make the jump to the Mets?
Well, in the winter of 1980, I had taken a job as the stat guy for Tony Kubek and Joe Garagiola on NBC. And about a month before I was supposed to start, I get a call from somebody who says, "Hey, I'm Jim Nagurny. I work for the Mets. You're kind of an offbeat PR guy. What do you think about coming to interview for the job? And we have new ownership, blah, blah, blah." So I said, "Bob," I said, "there's a friend of mine named Bob." I hung up on him. I said, "I already have a job. It's not funny." So the next day, I found this guy was legitimate. So I called it back. I said, I apologize. I didn't think this was a real thing. I flew down to St. Petersburg for the interview. I unfortunately went to the wrong hotel. I was late for the interview with Frank Cashin, who was a GM. Frank was sitting there, his little white tennis shorts. I was so nervous, I proceeded to knock over this huge container of orange juice in his lap. The interview lasted about 5 minutes. On my way back to the airport, I said, Mom, there's no possible way I got this job. And 40 years later, I'm still here.
One of the through lines of your book is that you don't really take yourself too seriously. Where does that come from?
John Franco was my mentor. He and with some other guys, too, Johnny always told me, and other players told me, the locker room was kind of a different territory, and you got to be able to accept jokes. And he said, Johnny always said to me, if the guys don't like you, they're not going to screw around with you. And Johnny, I could have written a whole book what Johnny did to me. The best joke, we're in the old hotel, in Biltmore Hotel in L.A. He unscrewed a horse head from the lobby, went up to my room, got the lights out in my room, put ketchup on my pillow, put the horse head in under my sheet. When I walked into the room, I thought I had a dead horse in my bed. So Johnny says, you got it. And I never took anything the guys did to me personally. I took it as a sign of love, and that's why I was able to roll with the punches.
Why did you want to talk about, you have a glass eye, which you talk about in this book.
I do.
How come you wanted to talk about that?
Well, this is the thing is, when I was a kid growing up in New Jersey, when my mother was carrying me, she got contracted German measles. I got glaucoma in my right eye. So I had a blue eye and a green eye. I was ridiculed a lot in school. You know, kids can be cruel, and they ridiculed me. Then when I was in sixth grade, the doctor said, listen, if you don't have the eye taken out, it could spread to the other eye. You could be totally blind. So I had the glass eye. And I was always embarrassed to tell people that. I could see a little bit. I couldn't see out of a glass eye. Can't see out of a glass eye. And I said to myself, self, you're going to be 75 years old in August. Maybe you could, one of the reasons writing the book, it gives some people who may be born with one hand, with a finger, with one leg, with some kind of an unknown disease. If you buckle down and make something of your life, you can do it. Just because you're not perfect, doesn't mean you can't succeed in life. That's one of the really underlying messages of the book, that I hope kids read it, or, you know, when parents tell that, hey, you know, Jake got a decent career, he was born with one eye, and he did okay. And that was one of the things I hope to get out there and get across to people.
In 1998, the Dodgers shipped Mike Piazza to the Marlins, and he spent about a week on the Marlins, and it was highly rumored that he'd be coming to the Mets. That was a huge trade that summer. What was the week between Dodgers and Mets like when Piazza was on the Marlins? Did you guys have a strong feeling that he was coming to New York?
Honestly, I didn't know until the day. It was starting to be some speculation the day before, and I didn't really know. You know, you don't really know until it happens. Mike just transformed our team. He became a rock star. We didn't have a team of superstars at the time, and you know, we had more columnists following us. Mike, I didn't think, after the first summer, I didn't think he was going to sign back with us because he didn't play that great. He played okay, not great, and he got booed a lot, and he wasn't really happy, you know, but it turned around. And you know, Mike is a guy that could speak to a lot of different things. And I remember when he came that day, we had a press conference after the game. Al Leiter pitched a complete game that day against the Brewers. The press conference, we had in the old Jets locker room at Shea, was packed. And I say to myself, this is going to be a whole different kind of thing now. Because now we have a celebrity in our team, a future Hall of Famer. We all thought he would be. No, I had no idea really till, you know, usually we see stuff. Most of the times the stuff is speculated in paper. It doesn't happen. But thank God this wouldn't happen. Mike Rodonte had a great career and is in the Hall of Fame and where we rightfully belong.
And then another thing from the same Mets era, people might remember when Bobby Valentine, who was sort of a flamboyant manager in some ways and a very smart one, he was thrown out of a game and he came back into the dugout wearing a disguise that wasn't a very sophisticated disguise, so it was obvious that it was him. How crazy was your job that day?
Well, Bobby took most of the bullet. He admitted it, and he was just trying to. It actually was Robin Ventura's idea. Robin told Bobby. Robin kind of cajoled Bobby. Listen, Bobby, the umpires are not going to pay much attention. It'll be fun. The guys will get a big kick out of it. Nobody will know it's you. And you know, Bobby is. I tell you what. Let me digress for 1 second. In the 9/11 after the attack, no one person did more to help reunite the city than Bobby Valentine did. He was a tremendous guy and did a lot of great things. And Bobby's always willing to, you know, take one for the team. He sort of relaxed the teams. He put the guy, you know, the disguise on. He got fined a couple thousand dollars. And it was a good laugh. We had good fun with it. And Bobby was not adverse to make habits of fun at his expense either.
Are you working on the 9/11 anniversary game? It was announced that the Yankees and Mets will play each other in 2021 on that day.
Right. Yeah. And I'll tell you what. I'm. You know, 86 was great. But if you ask me, Jay, what was the thing you're most proudest of being with the Mets? Is what the organization did after the attacks. I mean, we had from ownership to Bobby to players like John Franco, Al Leiter, Ramon Ventura, Todd Zeal, Joe McCouy. We did all the right things. We went down to Ground Zero a number of times. We went out in the media. We visited the firehouses, the police station. Shea Stadium became a recovery area to get supply shipped down. And, you know, it was just, we just it helped the city heal. And when Mike hit the home run that on the 9/21 game, people took a deep breath. They were able to smile. Our guy signed autographs for the firemen and the police kids after the game. And it was really, you know, it's good to win a World Series. I'm proud of the ring. I'm happy I was a part of that team. But it was really looking back. And once we get to in next year, the game with the Yankees, it's to know our guys made a difference. We had the perfect team for that time because we had a lot of local guys. Franco from Staten Island, Bobby was from Connecticut, Al's from New Jersey, and they got it. We wore the hats. We donated money to Rusty's Tops Police Foundation, and, you know, we wore the, not to make it, to keep you, but we were the first team to wear hats to honor the service, the agencies who lost a person on 9/11. You know, police lost a lot of stuff and members, and so did the fire department. The court office in New York was four guys, and two of our guys wore hats for the New York court offices. And I remember we got a call from somebody, the wife of somebody who died, said how much they appreciated seeing the Mets represent their husband on the field. So stuff like that you don't forget, man.
Okay, I have to give my press pass back if I didn't ask you about the rumors that the Mets are potentially going to be sold maybe imminently. What do you hear?
I don't really hear much. What I read, the only thing I can tell you is I worked for the Wilpon family for 40 years. Fred and Jeff have been great to me, and whatever happens, I wish them nothing but the best. It's pretty good in this day and age for anybody to work for a team or a company for 40 years. I'm really just proud of the fact that I worked for someplace 40 years, and they've been really good to me, and I wish them the best whatever happens.
Jay Horowitz is the author of a new memoir called Mr. Met. He was the longtime PR head for the Mets and now works in the team's alumni relations. Jay, thank you so much for taking all of this time, and it's been a pleasure.
Be safe, and thanks for having me. Take care.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.